A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know the sound of a diesel generator echoing through a kilometer of concrete-lined tunnel? It's not a hum. It's a thud. A low percussive thud you feel in your chest before your ears register it. I've been watching the footage from these IDF media tours in South Lebanon, and that sound is the thing that stays with you. That and the blast doors. 3 tons of reinforced steel on hydraulic hinges, sealing off chambers big enough to park trucks in. These aren't tunnels. They're underground military bases.
The tours have been happening since the ceasefire framework with Lebanon. Israel's bringing in journalists from the Times of Israel, Reuters, a few European outlets, and walking them through complexes that Hezbollah spent years building. We're talking about subterranean command centers with dedicated ventilation shafts, rail tracks for moving munitions, communications rooms, medical bays. This is industrial-grade military engineering.
Daniel sent us this one, and he's asking the question that keeps coming up in the coverage. What are the specific engineering challenges in building these underground command centers and weapons caches that would have made Israel certain the fingerprints were Iranian, not just Hezbollah's own work? Because on the surface, you could say, well, Hezbollah's been digging for years. Maybe they figured it out. But the IDF isn't saying maybe. They're saying these are unmistakably IRGC-engineered facilities. So what makes them unmistakable?
The timing matters. These tours aren't just military tourism. They're part of a deliberate information campaign to establish what Hezbollah was actually preparing for. Not cross-border raids, not a few weeks of rocket fire, but a multi-year war of attrition fought from underground cities. The engineering tells that story more clearly than any intelligence briefing could.
If you look at what the journalists are describing, the Times of Israel had a piece on a complex near Kfar Kila, 50 meters down, with a rail system and blast doors and a full communications setup. You realize this isn't a militia digging holes. This is state-level military engineering, and there's only one state that's been building exactly this kind of infrastructure for decades and has both the motive and the means to export it.
Iran's IRGC Engineering and Construction Headquarters. These are the same people who built the missile cities under the Zagros Mountains. The same tunneling techniques, the same blast door designs, the same approach to ventilation and logistics. When you've spent 30 years perfecting a very specific kind of underground military architecture, you leave a signature. And that signature is all over these Lebanese complexes.
That's the question Daniel's getting at. What are those signatures, and why are they so definitive? What does it actually take to build something like this, and why couldn't Hezbollah have done it on their own?
Let's start with what makes these qualitatively different from anything Hezbollah has built before. Because that contrast is where the Iranian fingerprints become impossible to miss. The simplest way to see it is the dimensions. Hamas tunnels in Gaza, and I've looked at the engineering reports from the 2014 and 2023 operations, are typically 2 meters by 2 meters, hand-dug through sandy soil, 20 to 30 meters deep at most. The walls are sometimes shored up with wooden planks or thin concrete panels. They're smuggling tunnels that got repurposed for combat. What the IDF is showing journalists in South Lebanon is something else entirely.
What are the actual numbers?
40 to 80 meters deep. Reinforced concrete walls, 1 to 2 meters thick. Bored with industrial tunnel boring machines, not pickaxes. The Kfar Kila complex the Times of Israel described, that's 50 meters of solid limestone and dolomite above your head. A standard 2,000-pound bomb, the kind Israel's Air Force drops on hardened targets, can penetrate maybe 30 meters of reinforced concrete on a good day. 50 meters of natural rock plus a meter and a half of steel-reinforced shotcrete, that bomb isn't touching the command center.
That's not an accident. That's a deliberate design choice calibrated to a specific threat.
You don't guess your way to 50 meters. You calculate it. You need to know the penetration characteristics of the bombs your enemy has. the geological load-bearing properties of the strata you're digging through, and the structural engineering to make sure the whole thing doesn't collapse under its own weight before anyone drops anything on it. That's the first signature. The depth isn't arbitrary, it's threat-modeled. And the specification matches what Iran's IRGC has been doing since the 1990s. The engineering and construction headquarters built the missile cities under the Zagros using exactly this approach. Drill and blast through limestone, apply shotcrete lining, install blast door airlock systems at every junction. Same material choices, same depth profiles, same approach to compartmentalization.
Which brings us to the thing that really jumps out from these media tours, the blast doors.
2 to 3 tons each, reinforced steel with concrete backing, sealing gaskets rated for overpressure from multiple direct hits. These aren't welded plates on a barn door hinge. They're precision-engineered pressure vessels set into reinforced frames with tolerances measured in millimeters. The journalists on the tour describe doors that take 2 soldiers to open, even with the hydraulics assisting. That's not something a militia machine shop fabricates.
The rail tracks.
The rail tracks. This is the detail that makes the Iranian connection definitive for me. The complexes have rail systems for moving munitions, actual steel rails, graded to a 2-3% maximum slope so loaded carts don't run away, with switching junctions and loading docks. The gauge matches IRGC logistics rail systems documented in Syria and in Iranian missile facilities. Rail is the kind of infrastructure you only build if you're planning sustained, high-volume resupply operations over months. It's not for a raid. It's for a campaign.
The engineering tells you the operational concept. These weren't built to hide rockets for a few days of fighting. They were built to sustain a multi-year war of attrition from underground.
That operational concept is Iranian doctrine. It's what the missile cities are designed for. Survive the initial air campaign, then continue launching from underground over an extended period. The ventilation systems alone give it away. Dedicated shafts with blast-proof louvers, positive pressure systems to keep chemical agents out, generators in the 500 kilowatt range with weeks of fuel storage. You're managing CO2 buildup, diesel exhaust, radon gas at depth. These are life safety engineering challenges that require computational fluid dynamics, modeling, not rules of thumb.
Which Hezbollah doesn't have the expertise to do independently.
They don't have the geological survey capability either. These tunnels aren't dug randomly. They follow specific limestone and dolomite strata that provide natural stability and drainage. Selecting those sites requires ground-penetrating radar, seismic surveys, core sampling. That's a geotechnical engineering discipline. Hezbollah has fighters and smugglers. They don't have engineering geologists on staff. The IRGC has been selecting underground sites in the Zagros for 3 decades. They know exactly what they're looking for.
When Israel says the fingerprints are Iranian, they're not guessing based on politics. They're looking at blast door tolerances, rail gauges, ventilation system design, depth profiles, geological site selection, an entire engineering methodology that matches a known template.
That template has a name and an address. It's the IRGC Engineering and Construction Headquarters, and they've been exporting it.
Let's go deeper on the ventilation. You mentioned positive pressure systems and 500 kilowatt generators. What does that actually mean in practice? What are we breathing at 80 meters if someone gets the engineering wrong?
If you get it wrong, you're dead before the first bomb drops. At 80 meters depth, you've got 3 air quality problems that compound each other. 1, carbon dioxide buildup. In a sealed underground space with 50 or 60 people and diesel generators running, CO2 can hit 5,000 parts per million within hours. That's headache and confusion territory. 2, radon gas. Limestone and dolomite formations leach radon naturally. It's radioactive, heavier than air so it pools in low chambers, and it's the second leading cause of lung cancer after smoking. 3, diesel exhaust from those generators. Carbon monoxide, nitrogen oxides, particulates. Without proper extraction, you've built a gas chamber, not a command center.
The ventilation isn't just about comfort. It's a life support system.
It's a closed environment life support system, which is a completely different engineering discipline from dig a hole and put a fan in it. The complexes the IDF showed had dedicated ventilation shafts, separate from the access tunnels, with blast-proof louvers at the surface. Those louvers close automatically under overpressure from an explosion, seal tight, then reopen when the blast wave passes. The fans are industrial axial units pushing air through filters rated for chemical and biological agents. And the whole thing runs on positive pressure. The air pressure inside is slightly higher than outside, so if there's a leak, air blows out, not in. That's the same positive pressure design Iran uses in the Natanz and Fordow nuclear facilities.
The power to run all this.
500 kilowatts is enough to power a small apartment building. You're running ventilation fans, lighting, communications equipment, sump pumps for groundwater, possibly refrigeration for medical supplies. And you need redundancy. Typically, 2 or 3 generators plus battery banks for the gap between a generator failing and the backup kicking in. Then fuel storage for weeks of continuous operation. Diesel fuel in underground tanks with fire suppression systems, with fuel lines protected against blast damage. The logistics of just keeping the lights on and the air breathable is an entire engineering sub-discipline.
That's before we get to the blast doors themselves.
The blast doors are where the precision engineering becomes undeniable. 2 to 3 tons of reinforced steel with a concrete backing slab. That weight means the hinge mechanism has to be hydraulic. You can't just push it open. The hinges are machined to tolerances that keep the door square in its frame after taking a 2,000-pound bomb hit. If the frame warps by even a few millimeters, the door jams and everyone inside is entombed. So, you need expansion gaps, thermal stress relief, and sealing gaskets that compress under blast loading but rebound. These are the same door designs documented at Iran's Fordow enrichment facility. Built into a mountain, same hinge specifications, same overpressure ratings.
A militia doesn't have a machine shop that can do that.
A militia's machine shop can weld a steel plate onto a truck. It cannot machine a 3-ton blast door with hydraulic actuation and multi-hit overpressure gaskets. That requires a foundry, a precision machining facility, and engineers who understand blast dynamics. Iran has all three. The IRGC's engineering corps has been refining these door designs since the 1990s, and they show up identically in Lebanon.
Then the rail system ties it all together.
The rail system is the detail that tells you the operational intent. These aren't mine carts on wobbly tracks. They're steel rails on graded beds with a maximum 2-3% slope. That's the engineering standard for loaded carts, so they don't roll uncontrolled. You need switching junctions where tunnels intersect, loading docks with overhead clearance for munitions pallets, and turning radii wide enough for the cart length. The gauge matches IRGC logistics rail systems documented in Syria. Rail gauge is a design choice, like choosing metric or imperial. When the gauge matches, you're looking at the same engineering template.
Rail is the kind of infrastructure you only build if you're moving serious tonnage regularly.
A smuggling tunnel moves things by hand or by small cart. You don't lay steel rail for that. Rail means you're moving thousands of pounds of munitions, fuel, food, and medical supplies on a schedule. It means you're planning for sustained operations measured in months, not days. It's the logistics backbone of a military base, not a hideout. And that logistics concept, underground rail resupplied to survive an extended air campaign, is lifted directly from Iran's missile city doctrine. The missile cities under the Zagros have the same rail systems, same gauge, same slope engineering. The IRGC built a template, and they stamped it out in Lebanon.
Those are the engineering signatures. Depth, blast doors, ventilation, rail. But the thing that's been turning over in my head is what all of this means for intelligence gathering. If Iran built these, they also built in counter-surveillance measures. You don't spend 3 decades perfecting underground facilities without learning how to hide them.
That's the part of the IDF tours that journalists don't get shown, the counterintelligence features. The complexes have electromagnetic shielding built into the walls, copper mesh and conductive coatings that block signals from penetrating in or leaking out. You can't just park overhead with a ground-penetrating radar unit and map the layout. The thermal insulation is just as deliberate. The ventilation exhaust is baffled and dispersed so it doesn't create a heat signature an IR drone can spot. And there are multiple false entrances. Some complexes have 3 or 4 access points that lead to dead-end chambers designed to look like the real thing, while the actual command center is behind a concealed blast door you'd walk right past.
Which means, finding these wasn't just a matter of flying a drone with a thermal camera.
Israel's certainty about Iranian involvement comes from 3 streams that don't rely on overhead imaging. The first is signals intelligence. Communications intercepts between IRGC engineers and Hezbollah construction coordinators. These aren't generals having strategic conversations. They're engineers arguing about concrete cure times and rebar grades. The second is human intelligence. Captured operatives who describe the Iranian advisors on site, directing the tunneling crews. The third is the materials themselves. The concrete additives, the specific rebar grades, the hydraulic fluid and the blast door mechanisms. They trace back to Iranian manufacturers. When the rebar has a metallurgical composition matching Iranian state foundries, you're not guessing anymore.
The certainty isn't from one smoking gun. It's a forensic picture built from signals, human sources, and materials analysis.
That forensic picture tells you something unsettling about the targeting problem. These tunnels are designed to survive multiple bunker buster strikes. The US GBU-43 and GBU-57 can punch through maybe 60 meters of reinforced concrete on an optimal trajectory, but these complexes are at 80 meters, with 90-degree turns every few hundred meters to dissipate blast waves. A bomb hits the surface, the shock wave travels down the access shaft, hits a right-angle turn, and loses most of its energy. By the time it reaches the third turn, you're feeling a rumble, not a blast. Israel's new penetration weapons. The MPR-500, the SPICE-250, with bunker buster warheads. They're impressive, but they're not 80 meters of limestone impressive.
The kinetic option doesn't really close the door.
It forces a strategic shift. Instead of trying to destroy the tunnels from the air, you control the surface above them. You cut off the ventilation intakes, you block the access shafts, you starve them of supplies. It's siege warfare, not strike warfare. And siege warfare takes time and troops. You have to hold the ground above a complex for weeks or months while the people inside run out of fuel, food, and oxygen. That's a completely different military campaign than what Israel planned for in 2006.
That's before you get to the proliferation problem. If Iran can build these in Lebanon, they can build them anywhere they have proxies.
That's the real strategic threat. In 2024, the IDF found a tunnel in Syria near the Golan Heights, same blast door design, same rail gauge, same ventilation shaft configuration. That confirmed the template had been exported beyond Lebanon. And now the question is, where else? Iraq has Iranian-aligned militias with territory to dig. The Houthis in Yemen have mountains that make the Zagros look like foothills. And the engineering knowledge itself is the most transferable asset. IRGC engineers have now trained Hezbollah crews who can train others. It's the same model Iran used to proliferate drone technology. Build it once, document the template, export it.
For Israel's military planning, this rewrites the calculus of any future ground war in Lebanon. It's not a quick incursion to destroy rocket launchers. It's a subterranean campaign.
Clearing tunnels room by room, dealing with booby traps, managing the psychological toll on soldiers fighting in the dark 40 meters underground. The IDF has been training for this since 2014 at the Samur Tunnel Warfare School, but the scale here is unprecedented. In Gaza, the tunnels were narrow, hand-dug, and relatively shallow. In Lebanon, you're clearing multi-room complexes with blast doors, rail junctions, and defenders who know every corner. A single complex could tie up a battalion for weeks.
If we pull back from the operational details for a minute, and Daniel's question was really about how you know these are Iranian, there are three things here that matter for different audiences. The first is for the analysts actually trying to distinguish state-built infrastructure from locally improvised stuff. The signature to watch isn't depth. It's not even the blast doors. It's the logistics backbone.
The rail systems, the ventilation plant, the fuel storage, those are the tells.
Because those are the hardest things to build and the hardest things to hide. A deep hole you can dig with enough time and labor. A blast door you can theoretically buy on a black market or salvage from a decommissioned facility. But a graded rail system with switching junctions and loading docks, a positive pressure ventilation plant with blast-proof louvers and 500 kilowatts of generating capacity and weeks of diesel storage, that's not a purchase. That's a construction project. It requires civil engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, all coordinated. And it leaves a physical footprint that's impossible to erase.
That footprint is what intelligence agencies should be training their analysts to look for. The ventilation shafts have to reach the surface somewhere. The fuel tanks have to be resupplied, which means access routes, which means vehicle tracks, which means a logistics tail that connects back to the surface world. You can hide a tunnel entrance behind a house. You cannot hide the logistics infrastructure that sustains 50 people underground for 6 months. The power cables alone. You're running high voltage lines to those generators, and those lines create electromagnetic signatures you can map.
The actionable point for defense analysts is, stop fixating on tunnel entrances. Map the logistics. Where's the power coming from? Where's the air going in and out? Where are the fuel trucks going? That's the network that reveals the facility.
The second takeaway is for policymakers, and it's about how we think about Iran's military export program. For years, the conversation has been dominated by drones and missiles. The Shahid drones, the Fateh missiles, the whole precision-guided munitions proliferation story. But these tunnels demonstrate that Iran's engineering export program is just as significant, and in some ways more dangerous, because it's harder to interdict.
You can't sanction a tunneling technique.
You can't intercept a blast door design in transit the way you can intercept a missile shipment. The knowledge transfers through training programs, through IRGC engineers rotating through Lebanon and Syria, through construction manuals written in Farsi and translated into Arabic. And that means any ceasefire or peace deal in Lebanon has to include provisions for monitoring and destroying underground infrastructure, not just surface weapons. If the agreement only covers rockets and launchers above ground, you've left the actual military capability intact 50 meters down.
Which is exactly what Hezbollah is counting on. The surface disarmament is the decoy. The real arsenal is underneath.
The monitoring challenge is enormous. How do you verify that a tunnel complex has been fully destroyed? You can collapse the entrances, but the underground chambers might still be accessible through other shafts you haven't found. You can pump in concrete, but if the complex has multiple compartments with blast doors, the concrete only fills the first section. Verifiable destruction of underground infrastructure requires access you're not going to get in a ceasefire negotiation or detection technology that doesn't fully exist yet.
Which brings us to the third takeaway, and this is the one that's most relevant for the kind of people who listen to this show. The counter-tunnel problem is an engineering challenge that's wide open for innovation.
The IDF is investing in this aggressively. Ground-penetrating radar mounted on drones, seismic sensor arrays that detect digging activity, autonomous robots that can enter and map tunnels without risking soldiers. But the detection problem is still fundamentally unsolved. GPR can find a tunnel at 20 meters in sandy soil. At 80 meters through limestone with electromagnetic shielding built into the walls, you're basically blind.
The destruction problem is just as hard. The kinetic options, bunker busters, penetrator warheads, they're hitting their physical limits against depth and blast dissipation geometry. So the interesting space is non-kinetic solutions.
Things like expanding polymer foams. You pump a two-part foam into a ventilation shaft, it expands to fill the entire void space, then cures into a solid that's harder than the surrounding rock. The tunnel becomes geology. Or directed energy, high-power microwave systems that can be lowered into a shaft to disable electronics throughout a complex without physically destroying the structure. Or acoustic approaches, using resonant frequencies to make a tunnel system uninhabitable without collapsing it.
None of these are science fiction. The foam technology exists in the mining industry for sealing abandoned shafts. The directed energy work is being done at defense labs. The acoustic approach has been studied for crowd control and area denial. The gap isn't the physics. It's adapting existing technology to a new problem set.
Which is exactly the kind of problem that private sector engineers and startups could tackle. The IDF has programs for this. They're actively soliciting solutions from the defense tech sector. But the fundamental physics challenges. Seeing through 80 meters of rock, disabling electronics at depth without digging, filling complex geometries with structural foam, those are problems where a clever engineering team without a defense background might have the breakthrough. It's signal processing, it's material science, it's fluid dynamics, it's not classified weapons design.
The three things to take away. 1. If you're an analyst, follow the logistics, not the entrances. 2. If you're a policymaker, treat underground infrastructure as a first-order disarmament priority, not an afterthought. 3. If you're an engineer or a technologist, the counter-tunnel problem is a genuinely unsolved challenge with real urgency behind it, and the solution might come from outside the traditional defense establishment. Which leaves one question that keeps intelligence analysts up at night. If Iran can build these complexes in Lebanon, what are they building elsewhere that we haven't found yet?
The Strait of Hormuz is the one that worries me most. Iran's been fortifying islands and coastal positions there for years, and the IRGC Navy has its own underground facilities program separate from the Missile City work. Underwater tunnel networks connecting fortified positions, submerged missile silos, command bunkers under the seabed. That's not speculation, that's extrapolation from the same engineering corps that built what we're seeing in Lebanon. And the Golan Heights. That tunnel found in Syria near the border in 2024 was a proof of concept. There are almost certainly more.
The West Bank is the wild card. The geology's different. More limestone cast, more natural caves. But the IRGC template adapts. And if the knowledge transfer model works the same way it did with drones, the question isn't whether the technique will spread, it's where it already has.
That's the future implication that's hard to sit with. The next major conflict in the Middle East won't be decided by who controls the air. Israel's air superiority is basically absolute. It'll be decided by who controls the underground. The side that can build faster than the other side can find and destroy, that can sustain operations at depth, that can move men and materiel through a subterranean network invisible from orbit. That side has rewritten the terms of engagement.
Right now, Iran's ahead on the building side. They've had a 30-year head start.
Which is why the counter-tunnel problem isn't just an engineering curiosity. It's the thing that will determine whether underground warfare becomes a permanent asymmetric advantage or a solvable tactical challenge. And for anyone listening who's an engineer or a technologist, the IDF's media tours from the past few weeks are publicly available on YouTube. They're a rare, unclassified look at the state-of-the-art in military tunneling. Watch them with an engineer's eye. Look at the blast door tolerances, the ventilation shaft configurations, the rail grating. These are problems that haven't been solved yet, and the solution might come from somewhere unexpected.
That's the weird prompt in all of this, isn't it? Daniel asks how you know the fingerprints are Iranian, and the answer takes you from geological strata to hydraulic hinges to the future of warfare. The engineering tells the story.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, road maintenance crews in French Somaliland, modern Djibouti, discovered that the basalt gravel used on Roman-era provincial roads exhibited an unusual optical property. When wet, the stone reflected nearly 40% less light than local granite, making the road surface appear to vanish under moonlight.
That's unsettling.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more deep dives like this one, check out our episode on Iran's missile cities under the Zagros. It's the engineering template for everything we talked about today. You can find it and every episode at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.